about 15 to 20 minutes. Today, the passage I'm reading is from Tahereh Mafi's book, This Woven Kingdom. Elise had only just pulled open the door to her closet when she felt it, felt him, as if she'd pushed her arms through the sleeves of a winter coat. She hesitated, heart pounding, and stood framed in the doorway. Foolish. Elise shook her head to clear it. She was imagining things. And no surprise, she was in desperate need of sleep. After sweeping the hearth, she'd had to scrub clean her sooty hands and face too, and it had all taken much longer than she'd hoped. Her weary mind could hardly be held responsible for its delirious thoughts at this hour. With a sigh, Elise dipped a single foot into the inky depths of her room, feeling blindly for the match and candle she kept always near the door. Mrs. Amina had not allowed Elise a second taper to carry upstairs in the evenings, for she could neither fathom the indulgence nor the possibility that the girl might still be working long after the gas lamps had been extinguished. Even so, the housekeeper's lack of imagination did nothing to alter the facts as they were. This high up, in so large an estate, it was nearly impossible for distant light to penetrate. Save the occasional slant of the moon through a mingy corridor window, the attic presented opaque in the night, black as tar. Were it not for the glimmer of the night sky to help her navigate the many flights to her closet, Elise might not have found her way, for she experienced a fear so paralyzing in the company of perfect darkness that when faced with such a fate, she held an illogical preference for death. Her single candle quickly found, the sought-after match was promptly struck, terra firma and the wick lit. A warm glow illuminated a sphere in the center of her room, and for the first time that day, Elise relaxed. Quietly, she pulled closed the closet door behind her, stepping fully into a room hardly big enough to hold her cot. Just so, she loved it. She'd scrubbed the filthy closet until her knuckles had bled, until her knees had throbbed. In these ancient, beautiful estates, most everything was once built to perfection and buried under layers of mold, cobwebs, and caked-on grime. Elise had discovered elegant herringbone floors, solid wood beams in the ceiling. When she'd finished with it, the room positively gleamed. Mrs. Amina had not, naturally, been to visit the old storage closet since it had been handed over to the help. But Elise often wondered what the housekeeper might say if she saw the space now, for the room was unrecognizable. But then, Elise had long ago learned to be resourceful. She removed her snoda, unwinding the delicate sheet of tulle from around her eyes. The silk was required of all those who worked in service, the mask marking its wearer as a member of the lower classes. The textile was designed for hard work, woven loosely enough to blur her features without obscuring necessary vision. Elise had chosen this profession with great forethought and clung every day to the anonymity her position provided, rarely removing her snoda, even outside of her room, for though most people did not understand the strangeness they saw in her eyes, she feared that one day the wrong person might. She breathed deeply now, pressing the tips of her fingers against her cheeks and temples, gently massaging the face she'd not seen in what felt like years. Elise did not own a looking glass, and her occasional glances at the mirrors in Ba's house revealed only the bottom third of her face, lips, chin, the column of her neck. She was otherwise a faceless servant, one of dozens, and had only vague memories of what she looked like, or what she'd once been told she looked like. It was the whisper of her mother's voice in her ear, the feel of her father's calloused hand against her cheek. "You are the finest of us all," he'd once said. Elise closed her mind to the memory as she took off her shoes, set the boots in the corner. Over the years, Elise had collected enough scraps from old commissions to stitch herself the quilt and matching pillow currently laid atop her mattress. Her clothes she hung from old nails wrapped meticulously in colorful thread. All other personal affects she'd arranged inside an apple crate she'd found discarded in one of the chicken coops. She rolled off her stockings now and hung them, to air them out, from a taut bit of twine. Her dress went to one of the colorful hooks, her corset to another, her snoda to the last. Everything Elise owned, everything she touched, was clean and orderly. for she had learned long ago that when a home was not found, it was forged. Indeed, it could be fashioned even from nothing. Clad only in her shift, she yawned as she sat on her cot as the mattress sank, as she pulled the pins from her hair. The day and her long, heavy curls crashed down around her shoulders. Her thoughts had begun to slur. With great reluctance, she blew out the candle, pulled her legs against her chest, and fell over like a poorly weighted insect. The illogic of her phobia was consistent only in perplexing her, for when she was abed and her eyes closed, Elise imagined she could more easily conquer the dark, and even as she trembled with a familiar chill, she succumbed quickly to sleep. She reached for her soft quilt and drew it up over her shoulders, trying not to think about how cold she was, trying not to think at all. In fact, she shivered so violently she hardly noticed when he sat down, his weight depressing the mattress at the foot of her bed. Elise bit back a scream. Her eyes flew open, tired pupils fighting to widen their aperture. Frantically, Elise patted down her quilt, her pillow, her threadbare mattress. There was no body on her bed, no one in her room. Had she been hallucinating? She fumbled for her candle and dropped it, her hands shaking. Surely, she'd been dreaming. The mattress groaned, the weight shifting, and Elise experienced a fear so violent she saw sparks. She pushed backward, knocking her head against the wall, and somehow the pain focused her panic. A sharp snap and a flame caught between his barely there fingers illuminated the contours of his face. Elise dared not breathe. Even in silhouette, she couldn't see him, not properly, but then it was not his face, but his voice that had made the devil notorious. Elise knew this better than most. Seldom did the devil present himself in some approximation of flesh. Rare were his clear and memorable communications. Indeed, the creature was not as powerful as his legacy insisted, for he'd been denied the right to speak as another might, doomed forever to hold forth in riddles, and allowed permission only to persuade a person to ruin, never to command. It was not usual, then, for one to claim an acquaintance with the devil, nor was it with any conviction that a person might speak of his methods, for the presence of such evil was experienced most often only through a provoking of sensation. Elise did not like to be the exception. Indeed, it was with some pain that she acknowledged the circumstances of her birth, that it had been the devil to first offer congratulations at her cradle, his unwelcome ciphers as inescapable as the wet of rain. Elise's parents had tried, desperately, to banish such a beast from their home, but he had returned, again and again, forever embroidering the tapestry of her life with ominous forebodings, in what seemed a promise of destruction she could not outmaneuver. Even now, she felt the devil's voice, felt it like a breath loosed inside her body, an exhale against her bones. "There was once a man," he whispered. "No," she nearly shouted, panicking. "Not another riddle, please." "There was once a man," he whispered, "who bore a snake on each shoulder." Elise clapped both hands over her ears and shook her head. She'd never wanted so badly to cry. "Please," she said, "please don't." Again, "There was once a man who bore a snake on each shoulder. If the snakes were well fed, their master ceased growing older." Elise squeezed her eyes shut, pulled her knees to her chest. He wouldn't stop. She couldn't shut him out. What they ate, no one knew, even as the children. "Please," she said, begging now. "Please, I don't want to know." What they ate, no one knew, even as the children were found, with brains shucked from their skulls, bodies splayed on the ground. She inhaled sharply, and he was gone. Gone. The devil's voice torn free from her bones. The room suddenly shuddered around her, shadows lifting and stretching, and in the warped light, a strange, hazy face peered back at her. Elise bit her lip so hard she tasted blood. It was a young man staring at her now, one she did not recognize. That he was human, Elise had no doubt, but something about him seemed different from the others. In the dim light, the young man seemed carved not from clay but marble, his face trapped in hard lines, centered by a soft mouth. The longer she stared at him, the harder her heart raced. Was this the man with the snakes? Why did it even matter? Why would she ever believe a single word spoken by the devil? Ah, but she already knew the answer to the latter. Elise was losing her calm. Her mind screamed at her to look away from the conjured face, screamed that this was all madness, and yet, heat crept up her neck. Elise was unaccustomed to staring too long at any face, and this one was violently handsome. He had noble features, all straight lines and hollows, easy arrogance at rest. He tilted his head as he took her in, unflinching as he studied her eyes. All his unwavering attention stoked a forgotten flame inside her, startling her tired mind. And then a hand, his hand, conjured from a curl of darkness. He was looking straight into her eyes when he dragged a vanishing finger across her lips. She screamed. The story of the devil had worn thin in the retelling, but Iblis, his true name, like a heartbeat on the tongue, was lost to the catacombs of history. His own people knew best that the beast was wrought not from light, but fire, not angel, but jinn, an ancient race who'd once owned the earth, who'd once celebrated this young man's extraordinary elevation to the heavens. They knew best whence he came, because they were there when he was returned, when his body cracked against the earth, and their world was left to rot in the wake of his arrogance. Birds froze when his body fell out of the sky, their sharp beaks parted, broad wings pinned open in midair. He glistened in his descent, fresh slick with fresh melt, heavy drops of liquid fire rolling off his skin. His drippings, still steaming, would hit the earth before his heft would, disintegrating frogs and trees and the sheer dignity of an entire civilization. Who would be forced forever to scream his name at the stars? For when Iblis fell, so too did his people. It was not God, but the occupants of the expanding universe that would soon forsake the jinn. Every celestial body had borne witness to the genesis of the devil, to a creature of darkness heretofore unknown, unnamed, and none wished to be seen as sympathetic to an enemy of the all-powerful. The sun was the first to turn its back on them. A single wink and it was done. Their planet, Earth, was plunged into perpetual night, armored in ice, flung out of orbit. The moon faded next, knocking the world off its axis, warping its oceans. All was soon flooded, then frozen. The population neatly halved in 3 days. Thousands of years of history, of art and literature and invention, obliterated. Still, the surviving jinn dared to hope. It was when the stars finally devoured themselves one by one, when land sank and fissured underfoot, when maps of centuries past were suddenly rendered obsolete. It was when they could no longer find their way in the perpetual dark that the jinn felt truly, irrevocably lost. They soon scattered. Iblis had been charged for his crime with a single task, to haunt forever the dirt forms that would soon crawl out of the earth. Clay, that crude, rudimentary form before which Iblis would not kneel, would inherit the world the jinn had once owned. Of this, the jinn were certain. It had been foretold. When? They did not know. The heavens observed the devil, the half-life he was forced to live. All watched silently as frozen seas overwhelmed the shores, tides rising parallel to this wrath. With every passing moment, the darkness grew thicker, denser, with the stench of death. Without the skies to guide them, the remaining jinn could not determine how long their people spent compressed under cold and darkness. It felt like centuries, but might have been days. What was time when there were no moons to mind the hour, no suns to define a year? Time was told only through birth, through the children who lived. That their souls were forged from fire was the first of two reasons any jinn had survived the infinite winters. The second, that they required only water for nourishment. Clay shaped itself slowly in such waters, shuddering into a finished form while another civilization died, en masse, of heartbreak, of horror. The jinn who endured against all odds were plagued always by a rage trapped in their chests, a rage held at bay only by the weight of an unyielding shame. Jinn were once the sole intelligent beings on earth. They were creatures built stronger, faster, simpler, and more cunning than clay would ever be. Still, Most had gone blind in the perpetual blackness. Their skin grew ashen, their irises white, stripped of pigment in the dark. In the torturous absence of the sun, even these fiery beings had grown weak. And when clay, freshly formed, finally stood tall on steady legs, the sun flared back to life, swinging their planet back into focus and bringing with it a searing pain. Heat. It desiccated the djinn's unaccustomed eyes, melted the remaining flesh from their bones. For the djinn who'd sought shelter from this heat, there was hope. With the return of the sun came the moon, and with the moon, the stars. By starlight, they navigated their way to safety, taking refuge at the apex of the earth, in a blistering cold that had begun to feel like home. Quietly, they built a modest new kingdom, all the while pressing their supernatural bodies so hard against the planes of space and time as to practically disappear. It did not matter that djinn were stronger than the clay bodies, human beings they called themselves, that now owned the earth and its skies. It did not matter that djinn possessed more power and strength and speed. It did not matter how hot their souls burned. Dirt, they had learned, would smother a flame. Dirt would eventually bury them all. And Iblis. Iblis was never far. The devil's everlasting, shameful existence was a powerful reminder of all they'd lost, of all they'd endured to survive. With profound regret, djinn surrendered the earth to its new kings and prayed never to be found. It was yet another prayer that went unanswered. You were listening to The Big Snore. That was a passage from Tahir Amafi's book, This Woven Kingdom. Thank you for listening. Until next time.